Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 9th of May, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. Well, let's get straight on to important matters. Europe being well in the bracket, I think.
Well, indeed, because happy Europe Day, Brian. As is typical with Europe, of course, there are two Europe Days. We missed the first one. The first one was on the 5th of May, and that was the Council of Europe's Happy Europe Day. And today, being the 9th of May, is the European Union's Happy Europe Day.
Yeah.
Because if you've got three presidents, you've got to have two Europe Days at least. One would never do the job.
Thank you for that. Should we perhaps explain to our viewers that this on-screen graphic is actually...
It's a still from their promotional video, because they did a little promotional video to tell us how great the European Union is. And it's particularly bright and cheerful image, Brian.
It's particularly graphic. And what are we looking at? The tentacles of Europe spreading everywhere.
Absolutely.
Ripping apart the foundations of nation states, popping up in the pavements and generally causing mayhem.
Absolutely. And we should rest assured, because, of course, Europe Day is all about celebrating the EU agencies network. So there is their website, Working for You and Your Future. Bearing in mind, we're not really getting out of the European Union. We should still be paying attention to this stuff. One of the things that the European Union is doing today is they're holding a select committee meeting, Brian, on the Panama Papers, which, of course, is all about big data. And one of the issues that's been sort of I've been wondering about over the last couple of months is the whole fake news agenda and where are they going with it? And we seem to be getting a clue. So let's introduce fake news and also big data. And this, I suppose, began, the hints began last October with Channel 4 News tweeted this out today. Inside Cam Analytica, at Cam Analytica, this is their tweet. Exclusive look at how the group used big data in the US election. Now, of course, we've been told that it was the Russians who were influencing the US election. But in fact, as time goes on, that narrative seems to be changing. And now the big bad guy is Cambridge Analytica. And we'll come on to them in a second. So this was Channel 4 News tweeting out today a report that they did back in October. And this is the one, big data. How it's shaping the US election. You can find it on the Channel 4 News, the Channel 4 News YouTube page. So that was back in October. And fast forward a few months till a couple of days ago, and then The Guardian produced this article, The Great British Brexit Robbery, How Our Democracy Was Hijacked. And this was in, published on Sunday because it's The Observer. And they say a shadowy global operation involving big data, billionaire friends of Trump, and the disparate forces of the Leave campaign influenced the result of the EU referendum. As Britain heads to the polls again, is our electoral process still fit for purpose? And the author says, I'd been speaking to former employees of Cambridge Analytica for months and heard dozens of hair-raising stories, but it's still a gobsmacking moment to anyone concerned about surveillance. And she goes on to say it also reveals a critical and gaping hole in the political debate in Britain, because what's happening in America and what's happening in Britain are intertwined. Brexit and Trump are entwined. The Trump administration's links to Russia and Britain are entwined. And Cambridge Analytica is one point of focus through which we can see all these relationships in play. It also reveals the elephant in the room as we hurtle into a general election. Britain tying its future to an America that's being remade in a radical and alarming way by Trump. So who is the enemy here? It's not quite clear. Is it the Russians? Is it Trump? Is it Cambridge Analytica? Is it all of them? Are they all working in cahoots? This story is still a bit fluid, at least as far as the mainstream narrative is concerned. So we'll continue on. There are three strands to the story, the Guardian article says. How the foundations of an authoritarian surveillance state are being laid in the US. How British democracy was subverted through a covert, far-reaching plan of coordination enabled by a US billionaire, and how we are in the midst of a massive land grab for power by billionaires via our data. There had to be a connection between the two companies, this is later on in the article, between the various Leave campaigns, between the referendum and Mr. Mercer, we'll come on to him in a second, It's too big a coincidence, but everyone, Aggregate IQ, Cambridge Analytica, leave.eu, leave vote denied it. Aggregate IQ has just been a short-term contractor to Cambridge Analytica. There was nothing to disprove this. We published the facts on the 29th of March. Article 50 was triggered. So I suggest that everybody goes and has a look at this article. It's important to read it and try to get a grip of what is being said. This was then, so that was published last weekend. This was then followed up last night with an edition of Panorama, What Facebook Knows About You. Well, they started talking about, and this was followed up on the Radio 4 Today program this morning, but what they were talking about last night, they say that Facebook is thought to know more about us than any other business in history. But what does the social network that Mark Zuckerberg built do with all of our personal information? Reporter Dara McIntyre investigates how Facebook's powerful algorithms allow advertisers and politicians to target us more directly than ever before. And he questions whether the company's size and complexity now make it impossible to regulate. So here we go. There's the word. Now, of course, right at the heart of this, as we've said, is this organization, Cambridge Analytica. And they highlight it's the fact that it is owned by Robert Mercer, commonly known as Bob Mercer. He is an American computer scientist. He is co-CEO of Renaissance Technologies. Now, Renaissance Technologies is currently being sued by a fired employee, but Renaissance Technologies is a hedge fund. When I was working in the hedge fund industry, Renaissance was viewed as being absolutely the creme de la creme of hedge funds. Its Medallion Fund, which was its flagship fund, at that time they only allowed employees to invest in it. It had an annual return while I was in that industry of about 72% per year. So that's pretty good performance. It was absolutely seen as the hedge fund. This guy is extremely wealthy. And of course, who's he investing in? The likes of Breitbart. And of course, he's being presented as a big funder of Donald Trump. He's also a major benefactor to the Make America Number One Super PAC. And so he is the person behind Cambridge Analytica, and also this organization, SCL. Now, SCL says that it's working at the forefront of behavioral change communication for over 25 years. It's evolved into a multidisciplined group of behavioral research and communications agencies. They say that they're a global election management agency. A global election management agency. Isn't this what we're accusing Russia of being?
I'm just going to chuckle at this stage, Mike, because I think the lid is coming off this pretty quickly. Keep going, and then we'll discuss the finer points.
Okay, so Mercer, then, who owns SCL and Cambridge Analytica, was apparently he's accused of being an activist in the campaign to leave the European Union. And according to the communications director at leave.eu, Andy Wigmore, he donated the services of Cambridge Analytica to Nigel Farage. So somehow Nigel Farage is brought into this as well. Let's just have a look at some more about SCL. They say, as I say, they're working at the forefront of behavioral change communication. They are into commercial stuff. They're into elections. That's highlighted there. They're into defense. They're into defense because apparently what they can do is they call themselves a leading practitioner of psychological approaches to conflict resolution. So, Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's probably more conflict in the world now than there has ever been. So they're clearly extremely successful at conflict resolution.
They're extremely successful at getting this stuff in order to stir up hate and angst in countries. This is really what we're dealing with here.
I think that's absolutely right. And then, of course, we've got the Telegraph. Facebook set to play decisive role in general election despite being totally unregulated. And I believe that headline is where we're going.
One.
That is the
yeah.
key one, because this is what this is all about. This is what the whole fake news agenda is all about, regulation. And Facebook is going to be the patsy for this. They're going to take it on the chin, as it were, because the concern is that democracy doesn't work in this country anymore because it's been subverted by big data. And therefore, we need regulation. We cannot have unregulated messages appearing on social media at election time or at any other time.
Yeah. If I can just come into the middle of that, I've just been making some notes while you're talking. I think we should remember that behavioural change, which we've got two things going on here. We've got the collection of data. Why do we need that data on individuals? Because if you collect enough data on an individual, you can start to profile that person. So we know why the establishment or private companies would want to collect as much data as possible from whatever source, whether it's paying your taxes or it's having a look at your Facebook or Twitter account. Somebody is hoovering up information, and then the next stage is they are profiling you as a person. Now, in the background, of course, it was the British government that was going flat out to introduce behavioural change as a government tool. And this was the programme that was being run, first of all, through the Cabinet Office. It then went into DEFRA. And this is the British government's Behavioural Insights Team, where the British government was ultimately saying, we are so successful in being able to change people's behaviour, we're going to sell the technology to America and to Australia. We had Common Purpose, the political charity that delivers behavioural change. That was doing insider dealing in order to gain contracts through the Cabinet Office to train, reframe the top 200 civil servants. And then it's very interesting, and come on to your point about who is doing this. Is it the Russians? Yesterday, we pointed out on the news that The Guardian was trying to claim that two of these data collection and cyber security companies, New York Flashpoint Intelligence and Tokyo Trend Micro, were trying to blame this manipulation on the Russians. But the one thing The Guardian didn't produce is any evidence to connect the Russians to this. If we follow the cycle through, what we can see is that behavioural change backed up by massive data collection is being driven through the British government and its non-government agencies. And we've got a similar thing happening in America. So I don't see in the first instance that this is Russian-driven. This is driven through our own government.
No, and in fact, the whole Russian narrative, that it's all the Russians, they've had to dump that narrative pretty quickly. So wherever they were intending to go with that, they clearly can't go there anymore, because they're now having to admit exactly what they are doing to manipulate elections, manipulate public opinion. What they're admitting to here is pretty staggering. We knew it was there, but the fact that they're having to admit it is what I mean is staggering.
And this is the good work of people over the internet. This is the result of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, not believing what's in mainstream media, but doing the research work themselves. So let's follow this through with the BBC. I couldn't resist this one. It's the Mail. It says that Ofcom, since it's become a regulator for the BBC instead of the BBC Trust, has been flooded with claims of BBC bias. And in 1 month, they've had complaints on 60 broadcasts, which is apparently doubled. Now, the article then goes into the middle of the long grass, because it says it's good news for the BBC because the complaints are both sides of the line. People are saying it's biased for the left, or it's biased for the right. So therefore, the inference is that the BBC is doing the right thing. This was the statement that the influx of complaints highlights the extra scrutiny the BBC faces now that it's regulated by Ofcom. Now, what I feel about this is actually what's happening is that the public is doing the scrutiny of the BBC, and they're seeing that the BBC is simply a government spokesman. What did Ofcom decide to do with the complaints? If anybody's unsure, here's the answer. Ofcom has passed the complaints back to the BBC so that the BBC can deal with the complaints. If you're not happy with what the BBC does, then you can go back to Ofcom. So here we've got the start of the revolving door.
Oh, well, this is fantastic. So basically what's happened is that while the BBC Trust was in existence. Who was dealing with BBC complaints? Well, that would have gone to Capita, I believe.
Yeah. As the desk officer.
As the desk officer, yeah. But now that it, the regulator is converted to Ofcom, people have been contacting Ofcom directly. Ofcom is batting this back to the BBC, but the point is, for the first time, we're getting a true indication of what the number of complaints is.
That is true. And in fact, the BBC is supposedly upset that Ofcom has leaked the number of complaints the public are making. So 60 complaints, I think it should be more like...
No, 60 broadcasts.
Oh, sorry, 60 broadcasts, I beg your pardon. But we should be dealing in tens of thousands of complaints on factual issues of where the BBC simply does not do its job. And if that's a finger at the BBC, then we had to bring in The Guardian here with this article, "Tax is getting a bad rap, it's time to sex it up." And this is somebody Z, a rap singer, don't really know, don't care. But this is an atrocious article which says that because a rap singer has done some sort of song about tax, yes, he's right and we need to look at what tax we're paying. This is a mind-numbing article. This is the lady, I think, who wrote it, Faiza Shaheem. If you look at her background, she's sort of NGO. I'm not quite sure what she's done. She's got a master's degree in social sciences or something like that.
Ah, head of hospitality with Save the Children Fund.
Yeah, Save the Children Fund, yeah. But we just want to say, Guardian, did you actually pay money for this story? Because it is so appalling.
But this kind of follows on from the thing yesterday with that tax was an obligation.
I did pick it up from that point of view that this seems, and I've got another article a little bit later in the news also heading in this direction, you know, about getting people just to do what the government says. But as a crass article, I think The Guardian wins it on that one. So where does this fit in the picture? Well, thank you very much to our viewer who sent it through to us. It's from the Marine Times in the States, "Every Marine a Rifleman No More." And this is an interesting little story that the Defence Secretary, Ash Carter, has said he thinks it'd be a good idea if civilians came sideways into the American Marines, took up jobs, but they would be known as Marines. And of course, the fight back in this article is that either you're a qualified Marine or you're not. The reason I've put this one on screen is this is a very old tactic to help dismantle institutions. You bring in people who are not the real thing, they're not qualified. And we've seen this in happening with the police in Britain. We've seen it happening with people in even the legal realm, that outsiders are brought in not qualified to do the job. So what happens is the whole thing is slowly watered down.
I wonder if that is in any way related to the NATO-EU idea of merging military and civilian functions.
Could well be.
Yeah.
Well, as a comparison, this isn't or doesn't appear to be happening in Russia. And the Daily Mail getting very excited at the...
terrifying, apparently.
Yeah, military parade in Red Square. So that was the headline. A terrifying, here's the word, terrifying firepower as 10,000 soldiers march through Red Square. And there's a lot of pictures of this terrifying spectacle. Of course, there's over an eighth of the British Army mustered in one place in Russia. So clearly the Russians are running their military properly, unlike the UK under Theresa May. But of course, the whole thing is sold that this is some event that we should be incredibly fearful of. This is more the reality, and many people seem to forget this. The somber occasion is a show of respect for the 27 million Soviet soldiers and civilians who died during the defeat of the Nazis. So whilst the fingers are pointed consistently at Russia and President Putin, of course, this is the scale of the sacrifice from Russia, which the West simply refuses to acknowledge. And there was other comments here from Putin. He said there's There is no and there will be no force that could ever enslave our people. They fought to the bitter end, defending their homeland and did what seems impossible. So this was a very patriotic speech by Putin. And it seems to me, Mike, that what he was really doing here is the start of really uniting Russia and the military. And I think this is because Putin is taking the stance of NATO right up on the Russian borders incredibly seriously.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to Syria then. And this is Al Monitor saying Putin changes conversation on Syria with ceasefire plan. And what they're saying here is that the relationship, they're really pointing out the change in the relationship between Putin and Trump. And they're saying the United States nonetheless encouraged Syrian opposition groups to participate in the talks and declared that the opposition must also live up to its commitments with Turkey as the guarantor to separate from designated terrorist groups, including Ahrar al-Sham, which continue to hijack the legitimate aspirations of the Syrian people for a representative and accountable government. And of course, they're talking about the Astana talks there. So they say as Moscow has sought a reliable way to move the Syrian conflict from the battlefield into the political realm, the conflict has gradually claimed more Russian lives and drained more resources. The idea of safe zones became worth exploring. So this is all about safe zones and how the narrative has changed with the United States. And as a result, perhaps, Tillerson has now agreed to meet with Sergei Lavrov. That's going to take place on the 10th, which is tomorrow. And Ukraine, Syria and US-Russian relations are going to be on the agenda. Tillerson says on Ukraine, the sides will discuss the need to stop the violence in eastern Ukraine and resolve the conflict with full implementation of the Minsk agreements. On Syria, the secretary intends to discuss efforts to de-escalate violence, provide humanitarian assistance to the Syrian people and set the stage for a political settlement of the conflict. So this is what seems to be going on. But is it what's going on? Well, let's have a look and see if that is the case. Qatar Foreign Minister, the headline here from Al Jazeera saying no substitute for Bashar al-Assad's departure. So certainly from Qatar's point of view, and of Qatar, I would say, are expressing the British point of view that the safe zones, the so-called de-escalation zones, are not a substitute for getting rid of Assad. In other words, regime change is absolutely still on the agenda. There should be a clear message to say that the political transition is based on the Geneva 1 declaration, which ends with Bashar al-Assad and his regime leaving power and the establishment of a transitional authority. So we've got that. Then we've got this report, which this is a week old now, but nonetheless, I'm bringing it in here because this was another report supposedly from British military intelligence fed through the BBC. Syria continuing to make chemical weapons. So we continue to build this rhetoric that Syria is has got chemical weapons. It's quite happy to use them and so on. But then yesterday, Al-Mayadeen, which is a Lebanese satellite TV station, has reported this. And what they're saying this is hundreds of vehicles of various kinds, US and UK vehicles gathered at the Jordanian-Syrian border. What are they waiting for? They're saying the US and Jordanian military may be preparing for a massive invasion of Syria. They're talking about 400 American, UK and Jordanian military vehicles. They're also saying that at least 4,000 militants are assembled there as well. Well, who are these militants? Are they tame terrorists? Are they Al-Qaeda? Are we now working directly with ISIS? This is not clear yet. So it's a pretty fluid situation, Brian. We've got what appears to be some kind of movement on the Russian-US dialogue front. But on the other hand, we've got this kind of situation where with build-up of military operations right on the Syrian border. They're not there for the goodness of their health.
No, you did speak to the Ministry of Defence.
Well, I didn't get anything out of them. I think they were more interested to know what I had heard or was aware of than anything else. So they weren't making any comment.
Right. And a key point here is, of course, it was actually the BBC that broke that British Special Forces were professionally operating in Syria. No debate in Parliament. That was simply a decision taken behind closed doors. What we're now starting to see, and the question we should be asking, have more British troops now been posted overseas in preparation for some sort of invasion by the US and UK of Syria? We don't know, because these matters simply not debated in Parliament anymore.
In the meantime, UNHCR here, their headline is more than 1 million children flee South Sudan violence. Now, of course, the British government today are saying that the Libyans, for example, deserve more stable government and whatnot. We should remember that Libya and North Africa, major staging points for people trafficking and for migration. And of course, where are a lot of these people coming from? Sub-Saharan Africa and, South Sudan is part of that. What they're saying here is children make up 62% of more than 1.8 million refugees uprooted by 3 years of escalating conflict in South Sudan. And that's according to the latest figures from the United Nations. Inside South Sudan, more than 1,000 children have been killed or injured since fresh conflicts erupted in 2013. An estimated 1.14 million children have been internally displaced. Nearly three quarters of them are out of school, and the highest proportion of out of school children in the world. And I just wanted to remind people, of course, that it is Britain that has been most active in Sudan through the Department for International Development and Priti Patel. She says that what's going on in Sudan is tribal. It's absolutely tribal. So on that basis, it's genocide. But let's just remember that since 2004, the British government gave $326 million in aid to Sudan, another $114 million that was 2004 to 2007, another $114 million in 2008, more hundreds of millions since then. What has that money been going to? Bearing in mind that the situation has been getting steadily worse year on year since we started pumping money into that country, then I can only come to the conclusion that that money is driving the conflict and not solving the conflict. Is that an unfair thing to say?
Not at all. And of course, it was the first Sea Lord at Mansion House giving his Mansion House speech that said, well, first comes the aid, and following the aid comes British power. So we now know, because we're being told quite clearly by the British government that everywhere the British government is putting in aid, maybe the British Council is involved. This is nothing really about helping people. It's just the way of getting the door open to get global political power in those countries. So we're back on the subject, which is what's happening with children. We still say that child abuse is the engine of the British government, and it is still being covered up. We were fascinated by this headline. So this is the Plymouth Herald. Inquiry into sexual abuse of children will hear from victims and supporters in Plymouth. Now, this headline is not quite correct, because if you read the article, what you find is that the inquiry is busy talking with so-called stakeholder charities. So there's no prior announcement that the child abuse inquiry coming down to Plymouth to alert survivors so that they can actually go and talk to these people. These meetings were set up in advance, in secret. And if you're not on the list of preferred charity, then the inquiry is not going to speak to you. We challenged the inquiry this morning. They did ultimately come back. They seemed embarrassed. But nevertheless, this is the situation, that we're not actually talking to the people who've been abused. What we're doing is talking to charities, some of whom it's difficult to see what the connection is with child abuse in the first place.
And they will be saying, well, our research leads us to believe. They won't be discussing specifics.
Well, that's true. And the other thing is, and we've mentioned this before, that abuse survivors often point a finger at very charities who say they are there to help, saying that they are as dangerous as other organisations when it comes to trying to report what's happened to you. So is this a coincidence? We understand that just as the Nottingham abuse inquiry gets underway, Melanie Shaw has been moved. So she's now left Foston Hall. And we understand that she's been put in Newhall Prison in Wakefield. This seems to have been done in secret, in that none of the people, the small number of people who were able to write and communicate with Melanie knew. But she's now gone to this closed prison in Wakefield. And at the moment, we're trying to see whether we can get some sort of contact with her. So the inquiry in Nottingham opens. The one place that Melanie Shaw is not going to be is in front of that inquiry. And who has ultimately put her in prison? Well, of course, it was Home Secretary Theresa May. I think they wanted this lady, Melanie Shaw, out of the way while the abuse inquiry was going on. And if they were planning an election, they certainly wanted her out the way while the election was being planned. Because, of course, Melanie Shaw is one of many abuse survivors who is talking about involvement by British politicians in the abuse of children. So let's just remember the ACPO statement. We showed this. This is minutes of a meeting in 2012. But what we're interested in is that in the text there, in the second paragraph, it's casually saying 330,000 missing persons each year. We know that a third of those are children, 100,000, but nobody seems to be too concerned about this. Well, some people have decided to take some action. And if you visit the Forced Adoption Exposed website, you will see that a team has been targeting the house of former MP while the election is happening, Mr. Timpson, where protesters have been up on the roof of his house and he's had to move out, unfortunately. So according to the report, two of the protesters climbed on top of Mr. Timpson's house. One has since come down and one man is still there, having been on the roof for more than 53 hours. So we could say it's a peaceful protest. It's getting the message out. It's tackling the politicians direct. And why is this a good man to go for? Well, if we have a look at some of the data on the government website, we find that he's vice chairman for the Runaway and Missing Children Group. I don't remember this man standing in front of the BBC mic and actually saying, well, we've got a vast problem with 100,000 runaway children every year. We've got a vast problem with thousands of children being abused. I don't even remember seeing him on television.
I don't remember him commenting on the Liberal Democrat efforts to get more and more Syrian children into this country, Syrian unaccompanied children into this country, while so many of them were disappearing out the other side of British care system. Yeah. So he's kept pretty quiet on this issue.
He's kept very quiet. So we're going to say well done to the protesters, because they've now made the local newspaper and as a result we're alerted. So this is peaceful action, in my opinion. We'll just bring in this charity, Missing People. This is quoted in part of the report. Here's some of the patrons. We've got the Duchess of Gloucester. We've got that face I remember from Virgin there. So
yeah, Richard Branson.
Thank you very much. And Stephen Fry, who we mentioned yesterday, cursing at God. So we've got some upstanding and, of course, a face representing the BBC there. So I think a few questions for that charity as well. And we wanted to remind people that, of course, when the police are doing their job, police whistleblower John Wedger comes forward to talk about the massive cover-up of child abuse around the British government. Nobody wants to take action, whether it's Cressida Dick, Policing Minister Brandon Lewis, or the Prime Minister herself. I take it that she's not talking about child abuse on the election campaign, Mike.
I haven't noticed any suggestion that she is.
No. Well, she's got a helper because here he is. It's the Bish, the Archbishop of Canterbury, pushed out a letter which the Guardian picked up because he was very big on stability. And I think actually the journalist who produced this article for The Guardian was spot on, because they said this is fascinating that the Welby letter focused on stability, which just happened to be name, credit and organisation. I've missed, but it's appropriate. This is treason, May. Here is part of her opening speech for the elections. And of course, stability is constantly referred to. So the inference is that Archbishop Welby is pro-Tory. We know he's pro-banker, and we know that he hasn't done anything to work to stamp out the child abuse, which he admits is rampant in the Church of England. I'll just skip over this one if we may. Let's get through this one. Right, it's a little bit slow. Where are we?
Right, okay. So, well, this is the Family Education Trust, and they have released a report today saying that the normalisation of underage sex is leaving children unprotected to exploitation by adults, is what they're saying. And based on analysis of high-profile cases of child sexual exploitation, this study highlights an aspect of the debate, which has been so far neglected. It examines the findings of serious case reviews of child sexual exploitations in several parts of England, including Rochdale and Oxfordshire, alongside Professor Jay's independent inquiry into child sexual exploitation in Rotherham. And it finds the failure of professionals to detect the abuse of so many people in different parts of the country cannot be accounted for by the incompetence of individual officers or inadequate systems at the local level. Rather, it is to do with a culture in which underage sexual activity has come to be viewed as a normal part of growing up and seen as relatively harmless as long as it is consensual. Well, this is a fairly valid point, but it's not the whole story by any means. Let's have a look at what the Daily Mail had on their page, because they said how predators were allowed to get away with it. That was the sub-headline as you scroll down the article on covering this story on the Mail. And they cover Bristol and various other parts of the country, and where they completely miss the point. So if you want to get the point, again, you've got to look at the UK Column website and the Rotherham Common Purpose Effect, because although it is a valid point to argue that the children are being sexualised too young and this is leaving them open to exploitation, that doesn't explain the cover-up that's gone on in Rotherham and other cities around the country. And so please have a look at the Common Purpose Effect series of articles, including the Rotherham Common Purpose Effect, because this is another piece of the puzzle which is missing from the Daily Mail article, at least.
Yeah, and this is very, very dangerous, of course, because we've got a massive attack on young children, which is coming through the television with the BBC or other channels, and also through the newspapers. At least somebody is now flagging up the fact that this is dangerous. I think we'll leave that one. Well, we'll end on a note of a good note to say that we're delighted to be back in contact with Brian and Janice Doherty. I can say that they are safe and well. They have been through a truly horrific time. We have been in a little bit of a difficult position because for several months, it is now, we've been out of contact with them. And we know people have been asking for an update, but we've been simply unable to give that update. So we'd like to say today that they are well. David Scott has been able to speak to them in person. And we're now waiting to see what really they need and how they can be helped to at least re-establish themselves. They are still separated from their children. They have no idea where their children are, presumably still somewhere in Ireland, but absolutely no information. And as a result of the ongoing harassment that they've had by the police and other authorities in Southern Ireland, they've ended up losing the pets and the dogs, which were of great sentimental value to them because those were the pets of their children. So if we want a reflection of Britain in 2017, as Theresa May ramps up for an election, We were looking earlier at the sorts of topics the BBC said was important in the election. I think the top of the list was the fact that Tories are going to put some cap on energy bills, but the real issues about the attack on the Constitution, the attack on common law, the breakdown of society, which is clearly engineered, the manipulation of voting and the stealing of the nation's children and the cover-up of abuse, of course, are simply not mentioned in these elections. And Brian and Janice Doherty really form the perfect example of the, I'm running out of words really, the horrific state of Britain as a result of this mismanagement by all three of the main parties. So the good news is that Brian and Janice are well, and we will try and give you a further update, and we'll also explain what can be done to help them. But I think the immediate aim is to give them some rest, and also then to try and get them stabilised and into proper accommodation so that they can regain their strength to fight for the children.
Adrian in the chat box is saying he's curious about the disappearance of the Doherty Files link on the UK column homepage. Look, those links down the right-hand side, they change from time to time as stories come to prominence. You know, if once we get some more information about what's happening with the Dohertys and what we're going to do about it, I would imagine that will come back.
Yes, indeed. We'll also just say in the slide that we've put up on Melanie Shaw is the address of her new prison location. We cannot get mail through to her. It's definitely censored. But what Melanie desperately needs, of course, is letters and postcards of support from the public to keep her sane. She's now been in prison for close on 1 year. There is no sign of her being released. And of course, most of that time she spent in solitary confinement. So if you meet a Tory MP on the campaign trail, Melanie Shaw is a key topic because, of course, Theresa May and Amber Rudd are the two women responsible for the imprisonment of this child abuse whistleblower. That's it for today. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.